Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about our national food culture, whether one even exists, and if it does, where it comes from, and what it says about us. Sophie Egan is Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. Her curiosity about American food culture is understood. She wrote about it in a new book entitled Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Sophie Egan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You know, we often hear that we don't have a particular food culture because we are so ethnically diverse in the United States. But you wrote that you can't kick the idea that we share a certain psyche about food. And voila, you wrote a book about it. So what do we mean by food culture versus psyche about food and so on?
Yes, exactly. That was the notion that I was really trying to counter. And I was just so curious about what could be said about what unites us, because it is often said how diverse we are. And without question, our diversity is one of our greatest attributes as a country. But in the course of my research, I found that these three commonly held core values as Americans really thread across our history as a people, and they shape our food choices in ways that are often subconscious. So in setting out to define American food culture, what really came to the surface were how much we work. As Americans, we are outworking ourselves even. We're known around the world for this productivity, but we now work actually 200 more hours per year than we did in 1970. We outwork the average of major developed countries. And I argue in the book that it's not a coincidence that we also spend the least time of any of the major developed countries cooking food and eating food. So that's one example of an element of our collective, I describe it as psyche, but our mindset, our deeply ingrained values that we're brought up with from childhood about what it means to be an American, that truly shape our daily relationships to food.
Because our relationship with food is predicated in large part on where we spend our time.
Exactly. And really, the reframing that I set out to encourage us to do in this book is to look at the root causes of our food choices. So often I hear blaming individuals, or we're lazy and that's why we have fast food, or lack of willpower and that's why we eat tubs of ice cream or whatever it is. These sort of negative traits of our character, and I wanted to pull the lens back and gain this real, or I should say, offer readers this bird's eye perspective on ourselves and say, well, what's driving that? Instead of, we eat this way because of these various shortcomings, what's really underlying it in terms of the environment that surrounds us? And one of those root causes is lack of time. There are, as described in the introduction of this segment, many factors. Lack of financial resources mm-hmm. is certainly a root cause as well that I hope we will start to look more at those starting points, but lack of time. It really comes down to there's only so many hours in the day, right? And people report, there's a fascinating USA Today survey, that found that every year since 1987, Americans report being busier than they were the year before. And whether or not they actually are, it's at least the feeling, the sense of, I couldn't possibly squeeze in a trip to the grocery store and make dinner, on a weekday. It's a very hectic pace of daily life. So for many of us, if we do have a chance to cook, it's on the weekend, which is such in contrast to the daily rhythms of the week.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the food culture in the United States. My guest is Sophie Egan. She's Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. She's written a new book. It's entitled devoured. From chicken wings to kale smoothies, how what we eat defines who we are. If you have a question or a comment for Sophie Egan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there to join the conversation. I noticed, you know, getting back to the whole blame game thing, that we tend to take up a lot in our culture when it comes to food. You know, obviously the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic, all of those kinds of issues. I noticed that you put yourself in the narrative a lot, like you put yourself in your reader's shoes a lot. I enjoyed it. Why did you do that?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you noticed that. I certainly feel the pressures that others, that I think most of us feel, definitely with regard to the example of cooking. I am not the cook I wish I were, or the chef I wish I could be. And much of it does come down to the sense I have of this endless to-do list in a given day. And I also don't feel that I have the kind of confidence in the kitchen. I'm also equally susceptible to many of the marketing strategies that I describe. So, for example, I explore this concept of nostalgia, and that how food companies know how powerful that is. And they make these associations with our happiest moments as children, because when you can insert yourself as a brand in a child's life very early on, and there's certainly much in the news about trying to restrain how much, you know, food companies can market to children, mm-hmm. but it's because that generates this brand loyalty throughout life. So I certainly find this myself. I struggle with it. I find that, oh, you know, Easter to me is when we would eat, you know, Whoppers made of malt ball Whoppers, or you know, any number of, you know, the different M&M colors that are limited time only at Christmas. And I definitely get that frenzy myself of, oh my gosh, I better run out and get it, or otherwise Christmas didn't happen this year, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's identifying how much, not only the physical environment of these different, you know, whether it's commercials or signage or sections of the grocery store that, you know, going to the grocery store can be just so daunting. And I certainly feel this way myself. But also it's our cultural environment. So another example of something that I've been guilty of myself is the fact that around me at a workplace, it is not only socially acceptable, but often socially normal to eat at your desk, mm-hmm. right? We've probably all been there, the sad desk lunch, as I describe in the book. Some of us, myself included, have probably been victim of sad desk breakfast as well. Mm-hmm. and it's just this realization that when you see your coworker do something or your family members, it reinforces to yourself, oh, this is what people do. This is normal, and therefore it's okay. But kind of taking that step back and realizing, well, we have to kind of all help each other in this. And it was only through really seeing the ways that my own behavior has been shaped by it that I think I was really able to describe it on a level that I hope is helpful for other people.
You wrote a lot about the whole work-related dynamic of, and it's so big because we spend so much time at work, so it's such a huge part of what we eat and why we eat what we eat. But I thought, gosh, at the Culinary Institute of America,
yes,
do the best?
Well, and I should say that certainly the experiences I'm describing in the book are not reflective of what happens at the Culinary Institute of America. that's certainly separate from this. But I've worked in many other offices in the past, so I have experienced that definitely. Where, you know, you either race out and grab whatever sandwich is nearest by, or you have microwaved items that I at a couple different workplaces, I have seen the way that people kind of stock up the refrigerator, you know, with their week's worth of what prepared meals. Or first time I ever saw someone microwave an egg was in the office, actually. So that really was new to me. It certainly smelled up the whole place, but a new trick that I've carried with me. So no, certainly the Culinary Institute is much different. But I recognize that not everyone works there. And we, one of the things that I do really enjoy actually is that the CIA, as it is called, makes it a norm to take a break. All the employees take a break at the same time and eat together for 30 minutes. And that's certainly the rarity. And I'm seeing more employers really try to encourage the kind of rebirth of the American lunch break, if you will.
You aren't the first person to ask a lot of these questions about our eating habits. In fact, you immediately referenced the annual report on eating patterns in America and the guy who writes it, Harry Balzer. And I was fascinated by that. You said, he said, pick a page in the report. You did. And he, you know, spouted off some statistics. It's just filled with all kinds of nuggets, not just about how we eat, but about how we are.
Yes. And you're referring to the report.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know that the research for this book was so much fun because there are a lot of people who do study our every quirk and habit for a living, and usually they are consulting to people who make food, but you know sometimes they're merely kind of behavioral economists or researchers for other reasons, and I found in particular. In addition to Harry Balzer and the example of the eating patterns, I find those who study customer segmentation, I find that really fascinating where there are these noticeable patterns of how the population kind of breaks down. So in essence, there's the people on one side of the spectrum who are always going to eat healthy and you know, they shop at Whole Foods and they have other lifestyle attributes, like maybe they do yoga or who knows. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have the people who kind of could care less. Maybe they're, you know, teenagers or they like the kind of defiant aspect of, you know, I'm going to eat whatever I want and forget, you know, who cares about the future. Mm-hmm. And most of us, the vast majority, are in the middle. And I find this concept really fascinating of like the health schizophrenics, as one person describes, where we might be health-seeking or indulgence seeking, even within the same meal, but definitely within the same day. And it's that oscillation, I think, that is a fascinating interplay that really is a theme for so many of us, where it's sort of, I was good and now I can be bad, or I was disciplined so I can treat myself. And this tendency to really kind of oscillate emotionally too with a lot of guilt involved with indulgence. And that's definitely another theme that has emerged through a lot of the research is that as Americans, we have a much harder time than other people just enjoying food. It's sort of like, you know, a taboo to kind of consider the pleasure of food or just the complete deliciousness. It feels like, if it's indulgent and tastes good, then it must be killing me in some way. So tomorrow I'll repent by, you know, going on the elliptical for an extra 20 minutes or something.
Well, it's ironic because we eat so much.
Yes. Well, exactly. And so that's kind of one of the things that I try to illustrate is we've got this swirl of emotions going on in our minds and kind of conversations with ourselves. And often this results in, often we're even unaware of how much mindless consumption we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I suggest, for example, with regard to a treat, you know, people now often will, especially in workplaces, there might be bowls of candy sitting around or cookies or pastries. And these are things that if you eat more mindfully, you maybe do treat them more as a treat. And then you don't feel the same way. You don't feel that, oh gosh, how did that just happen that I ate three cookies in a day? You say, no, you know, I'm intentionally, purposefully going to seek out this delicious experience. And I'm not going to do it, you know, three times a day. But yes, I am at a wonderful bakery or whatever the case may be. Maybe mm-hmm. someone made it for you from scratch and it was made with love. But I think that so much of our consumption, as you said, we eat more. We eat more total calories than we used to. Mm-hmm. And much of this, I do think is, not just I think, but the data suggests that it's coming from increased snacking, you know, in the U.S., we are snacking more than ever before. Most of us eat about 2 to 3 snacks a day, and we design our days around our to-do list, squeezing in food where we can, rather than the old paradigm where you had set blocks of time during the day that were carved out for meals, right? And you worked around those. But that's kind of thrown out the window, and people are stocking up on snacks, and it's normal. We see everyone doing it, right? They have the beef jerky in your purse, or you have your little drawer at your desk. Maybe you're in a meeting, or you're at a parent group or a book club or something where there's just food everywhere. I think it's fascinating. There's food at Staples.
I noticed when you wrote that, I'm like, you're right. You said it rivals the theater or a grocery store. Reminded me of a theater, kind of the candy selection you find at a theater, movie theater.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Very true.
We're talking about food culture in the United States, not to be confused with anywhere else in the world, that's for sure. My guest is Sophie Egan. She's Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. And she's also the author of a new book. It's entitled Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. If you have a question for Sophie Egan, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out the Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gluten is a real thing. 1% of Americans have celiac disease, which is a genetic autoimmune disorder where eating gluten can damage the small intestine. And 6% are sensitive to gluten, but fully a third of Americans avoid gluten. That means that the gluten-free diet enjoys a certain level of success in the United States. It is now a $10 billion industry. We're talking to Sophie Egan about why that is today. She's Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. Her new book is entitled Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. You know, going back to what you were talking about before our break, you talked about that blurred line between meals and snacks, and the whole snacking issue is why we're consuming so many extra calories than we used to. And in that chapter, you wrote that in the beginning, humans only ate about once a day, and now we eat almost constantly. Is that associated with a work thing?
I definitely argue that work is behind much of this sense that food is fuel, that we, you know, the real things that matter in a day are, you know, your to-do list, your, you know, delivering your deliverables. And it's not only with workers, but it's children, right? Many kids are more scheduled than they used to be. And so work certainly extends to homework and extracurriculars and so mm-hmm. on. So culturally, I do think we have increased, we really have gone away from the idea of downtime, of, you know, doing nothing is like, you must be worthless in society if you spend time doing nothing. In the U.S., we have a productivity orientation. I found this fascinating in my research, where we want to, much more than other people in other countries, we want to really have a lot to show for our time. And so that might come down to measures of efficiency in terms of being an individual worker. But even with our leisure, people in one survey announced that they would be more likely to choose an ice hotel than a really pleasant beach vacation, not because they thought it would be more enjoyable, but because it would be more memorable, distinctive. It's that kind of accumulation or collecting of experiences, the same way we aim to collect, you know, shot glasses or coasters or shells or whatever your collection of choices. And that's just very different from the idea of sort of being in the moment, just allowing ourselves. We have a little bit of guilt, the same way with guilt around treats. We have a little bit of guilt with the idea of leisure. So I definitely think that work is behind much of it, but it's not the whole story. And as readers will see in the book, I really home in on about three core values. And one of them that is most distinctive about Americans is individualism. We take this, we share an inherent affinity for the Burger King slogan, have it your way. Mm-hmm. And that what that really means is that in terms of snacking, we feel it's our birthright to eat when we want, what we want, with or not with whomever we want. And that definitely is a component in this increased snacking, because we're eating alone more than we ever used to. And when you're eating alone, you eat, there are all kinds of things that kind of go out the door. Maybe you down a whole Ben and Jerry's by yourself, or maybe you eat much quicker because there aren't the kind of social cues of sitting around at the table with others to signal a pace that might be a little bit more reasonable. I found it fascinating recently. There's this new utensil, like a smart fork, and it's called, actually, this one is called Spoon, and it tells you when you're eating too fast. It kind of beeps at you. And the reason I find this fascinating is it's clearly an instrument that is needed in an era when we're eating more by ourselves, because before you would be maybe having conversation more frequently at your meals. You would look around. Are other people's plates empty? Am I the only one whose plate is empty? Those kinds of things. So I definitely think this shared individualism and this sense that it is very much our right to customize how and what and when we eat are behind snacking. And in the book, I describe the other ways that this affects our eating. For example, customization. We've all been to Starbucks, right? And you've said your four adjective long order. That's, I want to be my special snowflake and have, the drink made especially for me, Sophie. That is a distinctly American way of looking at food, whereas other cultures look at food much more communally and much more in terms of interdependence, that you are part of a whole as opposed to priding yourself on how distinct and different we are from others.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about our culture of food in the United States and what it says about us individually and what it says about us as a larger society. My guest is Sophie Egan. Her new book is entitled Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Bobby in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, thanks so much. Great topic. I was wondering if you looked at how we eat has anything to do with what we're eating, as far as like the factory and the manufacturing of foods, bliss point with the fat and the sugar and salt trying to match to get us all to eat more of certain foods. I would just didn't know if you had, taken a look at that, or if you felt that had any kind of an impact on what we eat.
Yeah, that's a great question. And what Bobby is describing is explained in great detail in a terrific book by Michael Moss, Salt, Sugar, Fat, about that bliss point, that kind of the different levers that food manufacturers can pull to make foods actually as addictive as, a drug, in essence. The main area that I looked at that speaks to the connection between how we eat and what we eat really comes down to products that are one-handable. And that, I mean, can fit in one hand while you do something else with your other hand. So I was completely blown away to hear that some of these experts who study our eating behavior and, as mentioned, serve as consultants in the design of new products, they were realizing how much multitasking is going on, how much food is a secondary thought to whatever the other thing you're doing. Maybe you're on your computer, you're using your mouse, or you're driving, or who knows. And they've recommended, the same way that they have over time, cars didn't used to have cup holders, right? Mm-hmm. Now there are many more products designed to be one-handable. So breakfast sandwiches are a great example. And I think that's where the question of the you know, salt, sugar, fat comes in, because protein bars are another perfect example. There are now 2,000 kinds of bars on the market. You've probably seen the proliferation of Kind bars and all kinds of brands making
bars. There's entire aisles devoted to them now.
Right? There used to be, okay, granola bars. That's for when you go on a hike or something, right? This is now like the idea of snackfest I also describe in the book, where it's less common to have to make time or have time. 40% of us feel we don't have time for breakfast. So breakfast now is much more often a series of snacks throughout the day. And again, it's a protein bar in one hand, or maybe it's a wrap, you know, Hot Pocket. I don't know, this is another area that you may have seen where the options, the number of different varieties has increased in the freezer aisle. Are those things you can quickly microwave and eat with one hand? So those are the Jimmy Dean, the sausage egg McMuffins, or as I mentioned, kind of the lean pockets or hot pockets that are kind of breakfast oriented or lunch oriented, I should say, because it's getting you through your day.
And these so are some these are pretty highly that, processed foods too, right?
Exactly, right. And so, you know, so certainly some brands like Kind Bar has cleaner labels, as that shift is being described, or maybe it's more ingredients that you recognize. But much of the time, you stare at an excruciatingly long list of ingredients, and these are highly processed. And this is, of course, a problem, because about 60% of our calories and 90% of added sugars that we consume come from ultra-processed foods. So this certainly is not doing us any favors to be increasingly eating these types of foods.
Bobby, thanks a lot for that call. And Ann in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Oh, hi. I'm older, and I just find it interesting that when I worked, I could have a full dinner on the table within half an hour of coming home. But on eating, has eating taken the place of smoking? Because when people smoked because they were under stress. It gave them something to do with their hands, something to do with their mouth. Now people don't smoke, so they're missing that stimulation.
And at OSU campus, for instance, you can't smoke, supposedly can't smoke anywhere on campus.
Right. So people eat to replace that.
Yeah.
And that's a really fascinating idea, actually, and I certainly am intrigued by that hypothesis. I would say that absolutely people eat in response to stress. And it's interesting to think that the increase in snacking and kind of having something in your mouth that's stimulating all the time, at the same time that smoking is declining, is a very viable argument. I haven't seen any research suggesting that specifically. And in terms of from the public health standpoint, actually sitting is described as the new smoking,
right?
In terms of the relationship to longevity and so on. But I think that's a really interesting point in terms of how much of our eating is about stress. And I see this most pronounced in the workplace. A really sad figure to me is that 70% of American workers are either not engaged or actively disengaged at work. And when they describe the reasons why, it may be that they, you know, the quality of the job, they may feel overworked, they have low energy levels, and absolutely stress is always up there with the reasons for that. So I think that's really interesting. And to your point about that you could always have dinner ready and without within 30 minutes of being home, there's also a greater availability of options for dinner that aren't cooking than there were before. And so many times I find it fascinating that people really identify with what I say in the book, that sometimes it is a distinction between having time and making time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that argument applies to those of us who do or don't go to the gym or exercise, right? But and there are huge environmental constraints. So if you're working two jobs, if you have you know, maybe you're a single parent and so on. So everyone's situation is different. But definitely the incentives for not cooking are greater than they've ever been. What I mean by that is you go to the grocery store. Some grocery stores now are practically, you know, food courts or restaurants with the number of prepared meals that you can have in a moment, you know, ready to eat. Delivery apps. There are all kinds of services that within 15 minutes you can have dinner at your door. And the difference, of course, is that you didn't have to spend the time finding the recipe, going to the grocery store, and so on. So a lot of these are also being offered at price points that used to be, and for many, I should say, still are prohibitive, but they're lower than they used to be, and lower certainly than going out to a full sit-down dinner.
Ann, thanks a lot for that call. I just want to take another quick one. Well, I wanted to ask you a question. You found that in March 2015, so that's a little over a year ago, for the first time ever, Americans spent more money at restaurants and bars than at grocery stores. And that's pretty amazing, and it probably bums out the grocery industry. No end. But is reflected in how that's changed too, right?
Yes. Well, and actually, that's a perfect piggyback on my comment about how much more real estate in grocery stores is being allocated for prepared foods. Mm-hmm. And they are bringing in chefs more than before. There is a recognition of these changing behaviors. And so that's certainly one way that grocery stores are responding. One of the things I also find fascinating about that pattern that we're eating out more for the first time than buying at grocery stores is how much of that does appear to be driven by millennials. And they find that millennials are willing to spend more on food than previous generations. And so on the one hand, that appears to be encouraging because it means maybe they prioritize or have a place more value on food as a generation. And certainly there's a lot going on with conscious consumers, right? We mentioned at the beginning of this of the segment about ethics and how much that comes into what your food choices are. But on the flip side, it also reflects a certain lack of food literacy because there's a greater dependence on professionals in the food service industry to make your meals. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly a lot of concern among a range of different organizations that are doing terrific work to empower more people to have that confidence in the kitchen and to identify how much of what's happening is driven by feeling that they don't have the skills, that they might go to the trouble of buying all the ingredients, coming home and making something that's a total flop, and how much of that, what the different factors are that are behind this shift.
Thank you for that call. We are talking about the food culture in the United States. It's complex. It's deep. It affects us. We just mentioned that last year, March, for the first time ever, Americans spent more money at restaurants and bars than at grocery stores. That's, like I said, I think it's pretty amazing. What do you think? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or you can check out Facebook. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 40% of Americans eat lunch at their desk at work, and many prefer to eat while working at the computer or checking out their smartphones or gawking at the television rather than share a meal with somebody else. Today, we're talking about what those food-related behaviors say about us as individuals and our larger culture, and more importantly, how those behaviors have changed what it is we do eat. My guest is Sophie Egan. Her new book is entitled Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines who we are. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You write about this really pretty big dichotomy, Sophie, in how we eat in the United States. We're a nation of foodies. Columbus prides itself on its growing artisan beer and food options. But we also eat as much fast food as a decade ago. How did you reconcile that in your research? What do we know about why that is?
Yeah, this was certainly one of the most fascinating or most surprising findings to me, because there's this conversation about how we're all a country of foodies and the food movement, and people care about health and recognizing the relationships between food and health, perhaps more than they have before. But it's really this this fascinating distinction between what people say they do and what they actually do, and also between intention and action. Right. So 80% of Americans eat fast food monthly or more often. Half eat it at least weekly. And over a third of children eat it every day. So much of this does reflect the continued financial and time constraints that we've been discussing a bit. But I also find it really interesting the difference between not only fast food and sort of more, thoughtfully consumed, perhaps homemade meals, but also this disconnect between our more adventurous sides and the way that I'm sure that's happening in Columbus as well, where people are willing to try cuisines from all over the world. That actually about two-thirds of Americans eat a greater variety of foods from around the world than they did just 5 years ago. So that is really in a big part of the way we're characterizing our current food culture. But what's so interesting is that it's not reflected as much in what we cook. So when we make food ourselves, it does tend to be much more the meat and potatoes kind of older traditional quote-unquote American foods. There was a great piece in Slate actually this week about this exact disconnect that I describe in my chapter, The Story of Spaghetti, where it says that as much as people are willing when they go out to eat to go for all these new types of things, what they actually are more likely to cook are things like casseroles or, just a very simple baked chicken that maybe doesn't have many spices. And so I sort of describe the way that this is the silver lining, I would say, of our eating out more. Where it reflects this open-mindedness that we have as a culture and the kind of positive side of the instability of our food culture, which is that because we're open to change, because we don't hold on as dearly to the way that perhaps French or Italian cultures have a very distinct palate that's passed on from generation to generation, we can get excited about the latest food truck offering Korean tacos or naan pizza or whatever it might be. And it's this beautiful melting pot cuisine, I think, that is something to be really celebrated. As much as fusion cuisine can sometimes get a bad rap, I argue that it's one of the greatest parts about being an American eater. But in terms of the fast food versus healthy food, I also think that it's a reflection of there are genuinely also many more options that are that might be characterized as healthier. So there's a lot being done by large fast food chains, as well as new fast casual chains. Chipotle is the example of fast casual, but we have Panera Bread or a whole range of other new chains that are using better ingredients. And so it's also interesting to me to find out how we tease apart what fast food is. Perhaps what we're eating fast food more or the same than we used to, but it would be intriguing to see if that food is different than it used to be.
Ron in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Your whole discussion probably makes the point and a question I've had for some time, that is fast food and the local news. I'm not talking about paid advertising, but quite often on the local news, they'll spend 2 minutes talking about a new kind of sandwich or something at a different food restaurant and the fight back and forth. And I always ask myself when I listen to that, I said, I think, well, why is this a news item? And I think your whole discussion today has answered my question. But I just think it's an interesting that local news will spend their own news time to talk about these sandwiches and stuff.
So,
I think that's
fascinating.
Sophie, I think you're wrong. Oops, go ahead. Go ahead, Sophie.
No, I have a whole chapter in the book called Stunt Food.
Yeah.
And it really speaks to Ron's question, an observation, I should say, which is a great one. In the chapter, I describe the way that fast food companies, and I certainly don't want my previous comment to suggest that I'm giving too much credit to fast food companies in terms of their menus. I just am suggesting that there are new companies, such as Cava Mezze Grill and others that are perhaps using better ingredients. But at the same time, many of these fast food chains are using these over-the-top, completely shockingly bad for you new items. And they're limited time only. And it creates a false sense of scarcity in the marketplace. And because they're new, they're novel, they're fresh out of the latest R&D lab, they are news catching. It is impossible for reporters, many of whom wrote about Taco Bell's Doritos Locos Taco, the bright neon orange taco shell that gets the orange residue all over your fingers. We bought collectively as Americans 100 million of those in 10 weeks, which is completely unprecedented, and continued to purchase them at a rate of a million BLTs, as they're called, per day for the first year. And so it's one of the best-selling fast food items of all time. And you say, well, gosh, how could that be happening now? Well, I argue that it's like the physical equivalent of clickbait, right? Stuff that gets you to react that you, in your right mind, would not react to, but it's very powerful. It's this sense we have, it happens with the McRib. I don't know if maybe that's one of the ones that the news channel was describing, but there are all kinds. There's Shamrock Shake.
Yeah.
There are countless that I described in the chapter, the pizza wrapped in bacon. I mean, you name it. And it is designed to say, hey, you know, we're in America, we're a country of progress and innovation. Why shouldn't that be true of our food? And it gets us to react. And it includes certainly news reporters because it's just, can you even believe this?
Ron, thanks a lot for that question. We have an email from Katie that sort of goes to this issue about, hey, this is what we are. She says, could you expand on your comment about individualizing food orders, like the example about Starbucks? She asks, why is that unhealthy? Isn't it good to be able to choose to have your food tailored to your dietary needs or to be able to choose to make something low fat or healthier if you want?
Oh, definitely. And I'm in the book, this is certainly more clear, most likely, but I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily unhealthy. The customizing is more the realization that that's a uniquely American tendency. You would not walk into a French restaurant and say, you know, please remove the cilantro, or please, they don't have on the table, your own salt shaker or ketchup
right.
that you could tailor to your own personal preference. So I explore the various ways that individualism affects our eating. And with the customization, I absolutely agree that, especially with medical concerns, allergies, there are many now mobile apps and the fact that you can order your food online or with your phone that do allow you to assure that it's meeting your needs. Or I've even seen where, from a health standpoint, perhaps you do want to, remove, maybe the default might be with lots of meat or lots of cheese or something that you want to kind of ramp down and make a little bit of a lighter meal. So there are definitely great ways that this is coming through. But the part where I feel that individualism makes our eating less healthy is more with the eating alone. And we find that as Americans, as I mentioned earlier, it's very much feels that it's something that we deserve to do. Well, I don't have to eat what everyone else is eating. So, but as humans, we're social creatures, and those can be much more mindful, slower eating experiences. And I would not suggest necessarily, as I said, that customizing is unhealthy, but eating alone is not only can be not great for what we might eat or how quickly we might eat, but actually for happiness. Social connectedness is the most single most powerful determinant of happiness, according to research from the Greater Good Organization at UC Berkeley, as well as other happiness researchers. So I think we just are overlooking some of the greater benefits to well-being that come from social eating experiences. This commensality, conviviality are really quite endangered concepts in our culture.
Americans, something you bring up in the book, Americans eat anywhere, anytime. You gave some great examples of what people will do to eat while they're, gosh, someone was eating something while they were shopping.
I saw someone with their hand submerged in a bag of Snap Pea crisps.
Yeah.
While buying shoes.
Yeah, right, at DSW. right. And you said that's not true in most cultures. Again, is this this thing where we're rushed for time, we've got to multitask? Is it all going back to that same thing that we don't have as much time, or we don't think we do?
Yeah, I think some of it is that, and also, I also suggest that it feels that it's our right. The same way that the right to bear arms or the right to, there's this concept I describe in the book, the superiority illusion, which is the idea that all of there's been study after study that a much higher percentage than 50% consider themselves above average. You know, it's kind of an insult to be considered average in the United States. And what that means is just that there is, or it reflects this this piece of expressing our identity as very unique. And again, in the book, I describe all these different ways that this has been measured by psychologists. So when you're going to eat all the time, you're doing so because who's going to stop you? It also, I would argue, going back to the caller's question about smoking, it's socially normal. So if others are doing it too, there are not the kind of social rules that suggest that you shouldn't eat in that context. And what's really interesting to me, and I quote an anthropologist in the book about how this increase in snacking, the increased frequency, some people eating, you know, every 2 hours, this has really exceeded, this has outpaced kind of the etiquette of where there aren't really places where you don't eat, and there aren't really times that you can't be eating. And that's very different. We're all, whether we realize it or not, participating in this kind of radical social experiment. And I actually really think it's similar to the way that mobile technology, our smartphones, the way that our habits with those devices have outpaced kind of the social rules. You know, how there's this great concept of a phone stack. I don't know if you've heard about this, where at restaurants, some friends will force themselves to put their phones in a stack, and the first person who touches the phone has to pay the bill. And it's an example of kind of trying to create some etiquette around this. I'm suggesting that with snacking, we've got a ways to go.
Well, Sophie Egan, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sophie Egan. She's Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. She's also the author of a new book. It's entitled Devoured: From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Thanks to everybody for your emails and your calls, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.